Afternoon, Council. Ready to proceed?
May it please the Court, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely, David Wilkes of Reed Smith on behalf of Property Advisory Group. We are here today asking the Court to review a really most extraordinary award in the Superior Court. A Superior Court jury awarded an unprecedented $13 million to a plaintiff who had suffered injuries to the ends of two fingers that had been caught in a door. The jury awarded $3 million in compensatory damages and another $10 million in punitive damages. We've raised several issues in our papers. I don't believe that I'll probably be able to treat all of them as comprehensively in oral argument as I might like. I would like to start, though, with the one that I think is really the most clear and really the most easily dispensed with, and that is the issue raised by the United States Supreme Court's recent decision in the Philip Morris versus Williams case. That case is, it can scarcely be considered new law. It's really a natural extension of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the State Farm versus Campbell case, which is now, I guess, 4 years old. And really, it's fully consistent with this court's seminal Jardel decision, which is now 20 years old. What the Supreme Court held in the Philip Morris case is that a defendant's conduct or misconduct directed toward parties who are strangers to the litigation, not the plaintiff, but third parties, cannot be considered in a calculus of the amount of punitive damages to be awarded.
And what was requested in terms of a jury instruction to prevent that from happening?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, that particular instruction was not requested by trial counsel. Trial counsel very clearly objected to any punitive damages charge. I think as a natural extension of that, I think it's a fair argument that that issue is preserved on appeal. And frankly, Your Honor, I think the fact that the Superior Court's complete failure to take any measures whatsoever to protect these due process rights constitutes such plain error that that issue is properly preserved for this court.
I'm not sure I understand your comment, failed to take any steps whatsoever. Didn't the instruction talk about the relationship between punitive and compensatory damages?
It did, Your Honor. What it failed to do, though, what the Superior Court did not do at all, is explain to the jury that in no way can these attitudes, these perceived attitudes that Property Advisory Group's employee had toward the tenants of this housing facility, cannot play any role whatsoever in the measure of punitive damages to be awarded. No effort was made whatsoever in that regard. Rather, it's really quite the opposite.
No effort was made by anyone, including the attorney for your side.
Well, that's right, Your Honor. That's right, Your Honor.
So we're talking about either a waiver altogether, the argument, or at best, a plain error analysis. Is that right?
I think it is a plain error analysis, Your Honor. It's plainly an abridgment of the substantive due process rights, which clearly resulted in the result that was obtained. I mean, the Superior Court's post-trial opinion.
Now, the instruction that, well, what are you arguing is the instruction that, or analysis that should have been done by the Superior Court judge? The instruction in the Philip Morris case, is that what should have been given?
The Philip Morris case sort of leaves it to the states to devise the measures, but I think that anything would have been more appropriate than nothing. But certainly I think if when the case is retried and the jury should be instructed that, in fact, if you find that this attitude is relevant to the punitive damages analysis for reprehensibility purposes, whether or not punitive damages should be awarded, you must divorce those notions from your actual calculation of the award. Some measure of that along those lines must have been taken. The Supreme Court did quite the opposite.
Does that instruction also encompass the child who was injured at one of these doors?
The evidence, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Was the child injured by this very door or another door?
We don't know, Your Honor. The trial record is completely unclear. It's unclear of whether or not a child actually was injured, what the nature of the injuries were. It's unclear whether it was a defective door, a failure, a poorly maintained door. Could have been someone slammed the door in a child's hands. We don't know. The record is completely unclear on that.
What was the testimony about a child?
One of the property advisory group employees mentioned that she had heard something unclear, ambiguous, that a child several years before had got her hand caught in a door. That's it. There was no temporal sort of tie-in. There's no tie-in to the door at issue in this case. No tie-in to failure to maintain. Nothing of the sort. So really, there's really no tie-in to a pattern of problem here.
Mr. Wilkes, cited Philip Morris for the proposition that the defendant's conduct that's directed to non-parties can't be considered in the calculus of punitive damages.
Yes, Your Honor.
In what broader concept is that rule rooted?
Is that rule?
Rooted. That is, what is the basis of that rule under the Supreme Court's reasoning?
Well, I think it goes to a few of the real fundamental notions of punitive damage control, if you will. Fair notice to defendants.
I'm not trying to elicit an abstruse response. Are we talking about common law? Are we talking about policy? Are we talking about constitutional law? What is the?
Well, I think it's all rooted in a due process clause.
You think it is? I mean, did the court say it is? Did
it's
the court
all
say
in
that it's rooted in due process? That it's a matter of due process law. That rule follows.
That's the way I read the Philip Morris decision, Your Honor, because due process requires that defendants be put on fair notice of the penalties which they may face. It controls the potential for arbitrary penalties. And I think the decision really speaks in terms of we want to have society order their conduct according to a set of rules. And if we know what's going to be punished, then we can predict really what the consequences of our conduct is. And I
well,
think that
I,
all
I
goes
understand
to
that you can make an argument that the rule that you're relying on, Philip Morris, can be rooted in a principle of constitutional law. But my precise question is, did the Supreme Court say that?
Oh, I do believe that the Supreme Court said that in the Philip Morris decision, Your Honor. I think that's fully consistent with what the Supreme Court wrote in the State Farm versus Campbell case. I think that's fully consistent. But I also think it's fully consistent with the common law of Delaware. I don't think it's inconsistent as a natural extension of the Jardel decision, which holds that a jury may only award punitive damages to punish that conduct which is related to the precise harm that eventuated. Now, the any animus that this individual might have held toward the tenants of this housing project is wholly separate from the harm that eventuated to Mr. Galindez.
But doesn't Philip Morris itself say that a court, upon request, must protect against the risk? So what's the significance of upon request? Since there was no request here, doesn't that mean that this can be waived?
I think waiver is such a tough standard to meet, Your Honor, that I don't think the Supreme Court would have thrown that out blithely like that. I'm familiar with the phrase that you've identified, but I don't think that we can derive a waiver from just this. I won't call it a throwaway line because I don't think anything in the Supreme Court opinion is a throwaway line. But I don't if the court intended this to be an actual waiver issue, I think it probably would have said so a little more clearly. I mean, I would put this more along the lines of this court's decision just last year in the Sears versus Midcap case, where a court can really sua sponte, take control of the situation when there is real prejudice, when there is a real violation of due process rights
well,
or any other
that's
rights.
That's the plain error doctrine. That is, the error is so plain that any reasonable judge should have seen it.
Yes, sir.
That's your argument.
Yes, sir.
What is it, I mean, if you take out for the moment and for purposes of argument the due process element, what is it about this omission by the trial judge that was plain?
Well,
even if in hindsight, perhaps it was erroneous.
Can I answer that with an illustration? It's not a perfect analogy, and I'll explain why. But here's a quick illustration, Your Honor. An individual drinks a bottle of vodka, gets in a car, and drives down the road. He's he's intoxicated, he crosses the center line, causes an accident, injures another motorist. Clearly, I think we can all agree that that individual is subject to the imposition of punitive damages. The fact that he's intoxicated should come into the calculus of the amount of those punitive damages. Let's change that hypothetical a little bit and say that the individual drank that bottle of vodka and was driving around the road and was beating his wife, crossed the center line, caused an accident, injured a motorist. The fact that he's a wife beater, an abusive husband, we find that objectionable, we find it reprehensible. But I don't think anybody can agree that that misconduct, should be part of the calculus of punitive damages, of the punitive damages amount. And really, why that's not a perfect analogy here is because that's not really what happened in the Glendes case. Property Advisory Group has simply been accused of harboring an animus against its tenants. That's sort of like the guy's driving home thinking about beating his wife, and we're going to take that into the calculus of punitive damages. Now, I use that illustration, Your Honor, because I think it points up that it is very clear that when you are awarding punitive damages to an individual, an outsider at this complex.
I'm sorry, what I'm hearing from your illustration is that the error is plain because it's plain, at least to you. But in doctrinal terms, tell us why we should hold that it's plain.
Your Honor, I think when we talk about punitive damages, we're talking about civil penalties. We're not talking about compensating a plaintiff. The plaintiff has already been compensated, and if I have time, I'd like to talk about the fact that we think he was excessively compensated by the jury. But what we have here is a plaintiff who has already been compensated. The doctrine holds that a punitive damage award must be somehow related to that plaintiff's injury, both in quantum terms, but also in kind. It must the conduct that we are punishing must be related to this plaintiff.
Well, explain to me why a reasonable inference isn't that the animus translated into why the doors weren't fixed in the first place and that it enhanced what might ordinarily be termed negligence into reckless conduct. And why would it be plainly obvious to the trial judge and to the jury that the animus is wholly unrelated to the management who had the responsibility to fix the doors? Decision not to fix the doors in the face of their knowledge that they needed to be fixed and were dangerous.
I think Philip Morris covers that, Your Honor, because for that reason, that animus potentially is relevant to the decision of whether or not the conduct is reprehensible. Should punitive damages be awarded? The Superior Court put that all in its decision and said that's the reason why we think that the jury awarded damages, because they found this attitude abhorrent. And so punitive damages, therefore, were properly awarded. It may come into that analysis for the reasons that Your Honor just stated. But that's an altogether different question when we're determining the amount of punitive damages.
Well, that's why submitting a proposed jury instruction to the trial judge to consider giving to the jury is so important, because that's the way in which you draw those kind of fine distinctions in plain English for a jury to understand. And in the absence of a request for that kind of jury instruction, what are we supposed to do on review?
Well, Your Honor, I think what we ask the court to do, and which I think is perfectly consistent with the jurisprudence of this state and of the United States Supreme Court, is that this error is plain. It's an abridgment of Property Advisory Group's due process rights that were plainly set forth, not just in the Philip Morris case, but in the State Farm case as well. And so I think the court is well within its purview to review this, and even in the absence of a suggested jury instruction along the lines that we contend would have been
but
appropriate.
But at least in the context of Philip Morris, you would require us to write out of the Supreme Court's opinion the words "upon request."
Well, Your Honor, I would read that very broadly. And what trial counsel did below was vigorously oppose any instruction on punitive damages for a variety of reasons. And I think that the jurisprudence in this court and the case law in the Supreme Court are that an objection to a charge, which is what was made here, is sufficient to preserve the error, even if all the exact grounds are not stated. And I think we're well within sort of the ambit of that rule in this case, particularly where the Supreme Court has now made it so clear that this is a violation. The Superior Court's post-trial opinion, read next to the Philip Morris case, could scarcely point up the issue any more clearly. The Superior Court wrote in terms of, you know, a bomb dropped in the courtroom, and this was, you know, the defendants were doomed at this point. And it really took over the whole case, according to the Superior Court's opinion, which is what we need to go on.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Justice Jacobs, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Ridgely, John Harris on behalf of appellant and defendant below Narragansett Housing Associates. Narragansett appeals the trial court's denial of defendant's joint motion for a new trial or alternatively for remitter. As to Narragansett, the subject of that motion is the jury's compensatory damages award of $3 million. This court has the authority to grant a new trial based on an excessive verdict where the verdict is so out of proportion to the injury that it shocks the court's conscience or sense of justice, or where the record establishes that the verdict was improperly motivated by, among other things, passions or prejudice. As to the merits, first, the verdict is against the weight of the evidence because plaintiff's injuries do not support a compensatory damages award of the amount of $3 million. First, the record establishes that this plaintiff commenced this action, his suit, as an arbitration case, establishing that the plaintiff valued his own claims at not to exceed $100,000.
Why is that relevant? Why is that different than an offer to settle? Why should it make any difference to us at all that arbitration was sought or that there was an arbitration award in X, Y, or Z amount?
Because I think it speaks to the excessiveness of the jury's verdict. And in the Superior Court's recent decision of Lurie v. Montana, which we cited in our papers, Chief Justice Steele, Judge Johnston found the fact that the plaintiff had initially commenced his case as an arbitration case to be relevant. And it was one of several factors that Her Honor relied on in granting the plaintiff's alternative motion for remitter.
Well, in Cloud versus Walmart, I ruled exactly the opposite. Are you aware of that case?
I am, Your Honor. I think, with all due respect, Your Honor, I think Judge Johnston's decision postdates Your Honor's earlier decision. So there may be some inconsistency with respect to that issue. I think it's a discretionary issue, and I think that's why Judge Johnston was free to consider the fact that the plaintiff here initially valued his case at less than $100,000 in damages as a consideration in granting the plaintiff's alternative, I'm sorry, the defendant there's alternative motion for remitter.
Whether there's a consistent position taken by Superior Court on the issue or not, as a matter of public policy, is it good public policy if we wish to encourage arbitration to have some debilitating effect later on in the event if parties don't resolve the case at arbitration to a jury verdict that exceeds arbitration because we simply go back to the fact that the plaintiff asked for arbitration? That doesn't encourage arbitration, does it? It discourages it.
I would agree with you, Your Honor. Nonetheless,
well, your position, I gather, is that the fact that the matter was initially submitted to arbitration is a factor but not the sole factor.
Correct, Your Honor.
So where does that get you? It's a factor.
That's right, Your Honor. It's one brick in the wall. It's one element of the analysis with respect to whether or not the verdict is contrary to the weight of the evidence.
But you need other bricks. What are
they? And a second brick, Your Honor, just like the plaintiff in the Lurie case, the plaintiff here did not assert a claim for future medical expenses. Also, like the plaintiff in the Lurie case, the plaintiff here ceased medical treatment well before trial. Fourth.
And we'll move beyond this. If you're aware of Clough, why wasn't it cited in the briefs?
Candidly, Your Honor, I wasn't aware of it until preparation for this argument.
All right, so you have a case that was initially submitted to arbitration. There was no request for future damages. What else?
No request for future medical expenses, Your Honor. Also, the plaintiff here, like, again, the plaintiff in Lurie, ceased medical treatment well before trial. In addition,
Well, let's stop with those. Assuming that those are the principal factors, what would be the rule of law that would, how would you combine them into a rule of law that would enable us to overturn the result reached by the trial judge?
Well, I think all three of those facts combined, which are all established in the record, would fall under the heading of facts that are contrary, that would establish that the verdict is against the weight of the evidence. There are other bricks, if you will, Your Honor.
Well, we've run out of time for your wall building, unfortunately. but thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. Good afternoon. Richard Zappa from Young Conaway, Stargett & Taylor, on behalf of the plaintiff below appellee, Miguel Galindez. This is the third time that Mr. Galindez's entitlements to punitive damages and compensatory damages that were awarded is being considered. The first was the jury that considered everything firsthand, saw the witnesses in person, had the opportunity to judge the demeanor and the presentment of the witnesses on the stand, and concluded that the compensatory damages fair for this injury were $3 million, and that punitive damages based on the reckless misconduct of property advisory justified this $10 million, which is only slightly more than three times the amount of the compensatory damage award. The trial judge reviewed the same evidence, was there, and abided by the standard, whether or not the evidence supported the verdict, and concluded the same way, and had her own views that indeed the evidence could have justified in a compensatory damage award even beyond what the jury gave. She found that the evidence that the jury considered was abundantly such that the conduct of property advisory was reckless, and it was done in a callous way based on documentary evidence that was introduced, based on testimony of witnesses for property advisory who admitted consciously knowing that this condition existed, knowing that it was the type of a condition which would be expected to hurt somebody in the same manner in which Mr. Galindez was injured, and knew about it for the better part of a year.
You referred to a callous way.
Correct.
The evidence that the other side wished to introduce wanted to give a bigger picture of essentially what a big job and complex and demanding job of the management of this complex was. And that all of that evidence was not allowed, correct?
That is correct.
So wouldn't some of that evidence at least mitigate it? The sort of like, we're doing triage here. We have to hire special security to do this. The doors are on the list of things to get done, but we didn't get there because of these more important immediate issues. Wasn't that argument foreclosed?
Well, Your Honor, two things. One, I objected to the extension of the testimony beyond Ms. Reimel's interjection of that in her testimony, that there's rampant vandalism that goes on. We just can't keep up with it. And I, unlike the defendants who never objected to anything, I asked the court to do the 403 balancing. That is, Your Honor, look at where they're going with this and determine whether the potential for prejudice outweighs the probative value that they're trying to elicit. And the court did the balancing and determined that, indeed, it was too prejudicial to allow it if it was just global evidence of vandalism.
Why was it too prejudicial?
First of all, they were trying to do it through the testimony of a witness who could not substantiate it. And that was proved later because Mr. Baird was asked the question. The court left open the opportunity to bring in acts of vandalism that dealt specifically with Dorr. And Mr. Baird was asked, I think I asked him,
do you have any firsthand knowledge of any vandalism to the door? And he said, no. So anything that was coming in was based on a hearsay objection after that, an objection I made, which was sustained. What the defendants did throughout the case is they never objected to anything, so the court never could get into a position where it could do the 403 balancing. Hence, this court is bound to look at abuse of discretion as the only way in which to determine whether the judge acted improperly, which
but
the judge
didn't
do.
They didn't object, but they did affirmatively proffer evidence, and that was overruled, wasn't it?
It was. It was overruled with the caveat that the court left open the opportunity to bring in evidence that indicated that the vandalism to the doors was so overwhelming that they could not fix this door in question in a timely manner. So she did not cut off, the trial judge did not cut off the opportunity for the defense to do it.
Well, I think that means the doors in isolation, apart from all other work that may have been considered necessary to have done at the complex.
That is correct. That is the only issue that if one were to focus on would say, well, should the defense have been given opportunities to bring in global evidence? And it's just not the kind of decision that would constitute an abuse of discretion and require and deny the defendants a fair opportunity to present their defenses. At least that's the position of my client, Mr. Glendez. I'm more than willing to speak to the facts justifying the award of $3 million. What you heard from the counsel here who were not present at the trial is based on a review of the paper record. But the trial judge, I tried to put into the record, at least, that you had to be there to see it. I mean, Mr. Galindez was a very credible witness. When he discussed his pain, he was credible. He has pain every day. It's constant. Anytime he closes his hand, he has an electrical pain that goes up into his shoulder. Anytime he raises it at shoulder height or above, he has that. It hurts constantly, he said. The last record from the treating surgeon, he performed 3 operative procedures on his hand, was that the last time that he saw him, which is about a year or so before the trial, he could barely stand touch to the affected area. The doctor testified in the case, said that the surgery, the fourth surgery, it's a digital operation, was likely to be unsuccessful in curtailing significant pain. It's not controlled by over-the-counter meds or narcotics.
Mr. Zappa, let me suggest to you that the genuine concern here, if there is one, necessitates a focus on what is the relationship between the alleged animus and callousness that arguably came from the testimony of Ms. Rimmel and its relationship to both compensatory and punitive damages. We can take the evidence of your client's age, disability, pain and suffering over the balance of his life, the lack of contradiction to the vocational rehabilitation expert, the economist, and all that. We could segregate that and talk about it all day long and may well all come to the same conclusion. But the real element here that's unusual, at least in my mind, about this case is the interplay between Ms. Rimmel's testimony, the way in which Judge Jordan characterized it, and its extent to have an inflammatory effect on both compensatory damages and punitive damages, and whether or not that's appropriate in a case like this. Can you speak to that? And also, when you speak to the element of punitive damages, there's an issue that comes clearly to me, at least from the papers, on whether or not Narragansett's wealth had anything to do with a punitive damage award against management, PAC or PAG or whatever they are.
Correct. The animus is clearly permissible because in order to satisfy my burden of proving recklessness, it is fair game to determine whether the party acted with callous disregard. Whether the attitude of the participant was such as to reflect an I don't care attitude. So the animus of the witness brought out in her own testimony. I mean, she exuded it on her own. It wasn't like she was coaxed into saying what she did. It came from her. Its relevance to the compensatory damages is that it has no relationship to the compensatory damages.
Was that in response to your questions or opposing counsel's question?
I cannot recall, but I can tell you it was not elicited. That is the question. It was either in response to a question I asked that was volunteered, or it was brought out by the defense if they asked the question. It came from her own inner being. So to answer your question, Chief Justice, it has no relevance to the compensatory damage claim, but only to establishing the prerequisite of recklessness.
No, I know it has no relevance to it. The concern is its very existence in this case. Does it or did it have the effect of so impassioning the jury that it affected their compensatory damage?
No, because, Your Honor, the trial judge gave the standard pattern jury instruction, which explains to the jury that you're not to consider, those issues, the issues that would deal with recklessness in determining compensatory damages. So the pattern jury instruction covers the kind of matters that you would expect so that the jury is educated enough to know that that testimony is not relevant on the negligence claim or on the amount of the compensatory damages they award.
All right, what relevance does Narragansett's wealth have to a punitive damage award against management?
It doesn't, and I never argued it on behalf of Mr. Galindez.
But did the evidence come in?
The evidence came in for a different reason.
Well,
to show.
But did anyone give the jury an instruction to make sure the jury didn't run with that?
No, Your Honor, it wasn't.
Misapply it.
I apologize. Your Honor, there was no request for the cautionary instruction, which should have come from the defendant if they thought the evidence to which there was no objection at trial would have been misunderstood by the jury. I don't think it's for the party who's introducing it over no objection by the other side to do that. And nor is it the trial court's responsibility. The court...
Well, that's the argument that the other side made, that perhaps it's such plain error that it was the trial judge's responsibility to do it. Just salvage any substantive due process violation as a result.
Lastly, Your Honors, on the issue of the, if I may, go and discuss the question on punitive damages and the Philip Morris case, which really is not our case. This is not what we call the appropriate case that Philip Morris was addressing. Philip Morris involved a unique situation where the legitimate concern of that court was that the claims were against tobacco manufacturer, and the trial involved clear evidence that cigarette smoking causes lung cancer deaths, and evidence that Philip Morris had one-third of the market, and the legitimate concern would be that perhaps the jury might be confused in awarding an amount of punitive damages, which in that case was 100 times the amount of the compensatory damage claim. It might enter into the picture, into their thinking, unless there was some explanation by the trial judge. Now, in that case, there was a request for a cautionary instruction by Philip Morris, which was not given. And hence, the issue was narrowed. But it is just not our case. In this case, there was never any evidence that would suggest that the jury might be awarding punitive damages based on compensation to parties not in the case.
Well, what about the child whose fingers were caught in the door?
That's the only individual who had any involvement with injury and the door that the jury heard. But the relevance of that evidence was simply to show the danger that a free-swinging door without a closer made. They could have asked for it. They did not object. The defendants did not object to that testimony. And it was incumbent upon them. They asked for a cautionary instruction.
If they had asked for it, would it have been proper to give an instruction because of that evidence?
I believe it would have been. I don't believe I would have objected to it being done. Because the purpose for which I asked that it be considered, I mean, I asked the witness the question to establish that she knew, this is Ms. Rimel, the seriousness of the potential injury that can be caused by a free-swinging door, one without a properly functioned door closer.
Well, is there a chance that the jury enhanced a punitive damage award because they believe that PAG, quote, engaged in stereotyping, racism, showed zero understanding or compassion for economically disadvantaged or disenfranchised people and children? Is that... Did the trial judge correctly characterize that testimony, and if she believed it could be viewed by the jury in that way, was she not under some obligation to caution the jury that to the extent that element was present in the case, it bore no reasonable relationship to punitive damages that could be awarded against PAG? That's her characterization of how that testimony came across to her. Why shouldn't we be worried that it came across to the jury in the very same way and improperly influenced their punitive damage award?
I just can't answer it, be speculating on my part. However, I don't believe that the statements were quite as dramatically given during the course of the trial as the trial judge perceived it. I think she probably, in hearing the testimony and based on arguments which would have been made post-trial, the defendants seeking to invalidate what the jury had done, in the face of hearing such callousness through the words of the very party asking for the verdict to be invalidated, she resolving all benefits of the doubt in favor of the non-moving party would be apt to say that, to make it clear to the reviewing court that there was a significant factor of callous disregard. The animus is equivalent to the callous disregard.
Well, I mean, callous disregard related to the failure to fix the door is one thing. But my concern is the jury carrying into the jury room in their assessment of damages a view formulated by this one witness's, and I quote the trial judge again, callous and indifferent attitude about the residents and others on the premises as a result of stereotyping them and displaying a racist view, at least as the trial judge saw it. I mean, this is a very solid trial judge who's very familiar with civil trials and the way in which the jury system works, and this is a very strong characterization of a witness's testimony. And I'm trying to figure out in my own mind how it reasonably relates to this punitive damage award.
Well, Your Honor, maybe there's another way of looking at it. If the compensatory damage award is appropriate, and I'm hoping that the court will see it the way that the evidence was seen by the jury and by the trial judge, if that $3 million is appropriate, it bears a reasonable relationship to a jury's award of $10 million for punitive. So if we look at it from that, it isn't like the situation you might see in Philip Morris. It was 100 times that amount. And then you sit there and you say, wait a second, I think I can step back now and say.
I appreciate that, but I'm sure you can understand how one, looking at it objectively, would be concerned about the very same attitude bleeding over into the compensatory damage award. How well fixed is it in the traditional elements of a compensatory damage award and the extent to which the same kind of attitude of callousness about individuals, apart from callousness about the need to fix the premises, how that might have adversely affected a judgment about the appropriate compensatory damage.
It's a legitimate concern. I acknowledge that. But I also do point out, Your Honor, that there was so much evidence independent of the animus that perhaps that witness demonstrated at the trial to have justified a finding by the jury that the reprehensible, that the act was very reprehensible. And, you know, you're looking at the amount of the award and looking at the defendants who they were and the class of people out there, I still think, Your Honor, it's not the appropriate case where one can infer that it affected the jury significantly and affected their decision on the amount of the award.
Mr. Zappa, let's go back for a moment to the issue of Narragansett's wealth. Tell us again what the purpose of the proffer of that evidence was.
Two things. They took the position at the trial when confronted with surveys that were introduced showing longstanding neglect and failing to address the issues of the door closers, including the door in question, that they, one, did not have enough on-site staff to take care of the repairs themselves, and secondly, didn't have enough money budgeted for which third-party contractors, such as the co-defendant who was exonerated and who did the surveys, could be paid. Once they interject that in the case, I believe they opened the door to me doing an analysis to determine whether indeed there were enough rental, there was enough money coming into the pot for Narragansett to have allocated the kind of money to property advisory to staff themselves adequately. They brought it up, and I think it's a fair issue to raise when they're complaining that he didn't have enough money to do the repairs.
So if it's properly in the evidence is properly in the case, then the only issue that remains is did the jury have a clear guideline on how to assess it?
Exactly. And we go to the Philip Morris case, and I believe that the sense of that case is upon request in an appropriate case, a judge may have to step in and do that. And this in the Philip Morris case, the judge was asked to do it and didn't do it. That isn't this case. There was never any request. And it's not an appropriate case where it should have been done.
So your point is, number one, there's no plain error. At most, it's an abuse of discretion, and it doesn't rise to the level of a constitutional violation.
In fact, everything except the issue that Justice Ridgely mentioned about their attempt to introduce evidence and had it circumscribed by the judge to only the door in question. And except for that, there's no ruling they can point to from the judge, no evidence that was objected to that she let in, that there was no instruction they asked for. It's just not relevant to say that we objected to punitive damages. The question always is, if it's going to be given, do you object to the charge? By the way, the arbitration issue is irrelevant because in this case, unlike Lori, I might add, which was brought up in the reply brief, I might mention to Justice Ridgely, but the issue there was, in this case got recertified. I filed an amended complaint. It invalidated any proceeding that occurred before, and Judge Johnson's decision, clearly that was not the case. That proceeded as an arbitration, continued as an arbitration to its ultimate verdict. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, the Court, I'm mindful that I have but a couple of minutes.
Actually, you used all your time.
Oh, I did. I ran
went
into
right
my extra 2 minutes.
Yellow light. It was very disappointing, but you were on a roll, and I didn't interrupt you.
Your Honor, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.